The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story article, The Promise of Andrea Harris's Legacy of Standing Up for Minority Businesses in North Carolina Opens Up New Conversations Surrounding Equality and Inclusion. This cover story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal, first with an introduction by Triangle Business Journal Editor-in-Chief Sugata Mukherjee. The top half of the page has a picture of five men, very well-dressed, wearing ties, sitting in an office with work out on the desk. It is a picture of the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company officers, all African-American, circa 1911. The headline on the introduction, Why We Started the Promise of Project. It was not long after the killing of George Floyd that a well-connected Durham CEO told me that maybe it was time for everyone to see the widening disparity in racial justice. Facts don't lie, he noted. To me, embedded in the nation's rage over racial justice, inequality, and exclusion was one often ignored quotient, economic power and economic opportunity. Leading the news coverage at one of the fastest-growing metro areas in the nation, it became obvious that this business newspaper can forward that conversation by bringing leaders of the community together to develop and support a project intentionally designed to help black businesses. Soon after, a loosely formed committee of nine black leaders representing academia, business, public policy, and General Assembly lobbyists started talking via video conference to develop the structure of the Promise of Project. At the center was the legacy of Andrea Harris, the longtime proponent of black businesses who pushed large companies and government agencies to do business with the minority community. Her footprint can be noticed all over the project. The project name came from the direct conversations with the committee that believe the reference is appropriate given the nature of the goal, which is to create a vibrant bazaar for businesses to buy products and services from black businesses in the 16-county Triangle region. Every week, journalist Connie Gentry will write about the opportunities and struggles of a black-owned business in the area and provide a couple of topical briefs that would be of interest to minority businesses. These may include national reports, statistics, available government contracts, and/or individual accomplishments. Occasionally, the Project Dove series will do a deep dive on issues and trends of importance to black businesses. We're thankful for the corporate support shown by the likes of PNC Bank, Credit Suisse, First Citizens Bank, and Wake Med as their leadership jumped on the project as soon as they heard about it. Our launch section this week also includes a piece by the late U.S. Representative John Lewis, written for the New York Times, a piece that Lewis wanted the New York Times to publish the day of his funeral, July 30. Lewis talked about the need for love and understanding from all citizens during these troubled times. We hope you enjoy the feature. Reach out to me with your comments and questions at Sugata, S-O-U-G-A-T-A, at bizjournals, B-I-Z-J-O-U-R-N-A-L-S, .com. The main article headline, Building on a Long Legacy, Andrea Harris Paved the Way for Minority Businesses to Push Through Economic Barriers. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project. The project name is based on an historical reference relating to Union Army leader William Sherman's promise of giving 40 acres to slaves after the Civil War. That promise, which came to be known as 40 Acres and a Mule, never came through as President Andrew Johnson rescinded the order after taking office. Recent events have taken a disproportionate toll on African-American businesses. In the earliest days of COVID-19, the number of African-American business owners plummeted from 1.1 million in February to 640,000 by mid-April, a precipitous 41% drop in small businesses owned by the black community, according to research conducted by the University of California, Santa Cruz. By comparison, small businesses owned by whites dropped 17%. Asian-owned businesses dropped 26%, and businesses in the Latinx community dropped 32%. The biggest problem is that those trends are nothing new. African Americans have faced economic inequalities throughout the country's history. Since 2008, the African American community has lost $1 trillion of net worth, reports Kevin Price, president and CEO of the North Carolina Institute of Minority Economic Development. Who knows how much more net wealth we've lost since COVID? The two main ways of building net worth are home ownership and business ownership, and now we're seeing a large hit from the business perspective, Price says. There needs to be a lot of intentional effort to rebuild minority communities. Just throwing money out there is not the answer. It's how you partner with the right organizations to get resources to the right people to make a difference. Addressing challenges and leveraging opportunities is the dual purpose of the Institute, which was founded in 1986 by Andrea Harris. The May passing of Harris, a prominent civil rights leader, is another monumental loss for the black community. But like Congressman John Lewis, who died in late July, and many others before him, Harris's legacy has paved the way for future progress. Price, who began leading the Institute in March, leans heavily on the vision imparted by Harris. How do we create more economic opportunities for people of color who have historically been left behind, some intentionally, some unintentionally? The answer, he says, is to understand that we have to bring intentionality to it in order to change it. Economic realities. A sustained commitment to build up the black community has been sorely lacking on virtually every front. Since the end of the Civil War, there's been more regression than ascension for African Americans. 40 acres and a mule never happened, and promises of support and equality have failed to materialize. African American people should have the same numbers that white people have. The gaps are what kill us, says Julian Malveau, a labor economist, author, commentator, and former president of Benedict College. Black people have less than 10% of the wealth that white people have. Interestingly, we went from having $1 for every $36 that white people had in 1880 down to $1 for every $13 that white people had in 1910. And now, 100 years later, it's $1 for every $10 that white people have. The Survey of Consumer Finances reported the median net worth for a black household in 2016 was $17,600, compared to a median net worth in the white households of $171,000. In their book, From Here to Equality, published in March, Duke University professor William A. Darity Jr. and A. Kirsten Mullen wrote, "For every dollar the middle white household holds in wealth, measured by assets like homes, cash savings, and retirement funds, the middle black household possess a mere 10 cents. Those economic realities put the American dream of financial independence and entrepreneurial ownership beyond the grasp of most black people. Andrea Harris was passionate about many things, but one of them was minority entrepreneurship. She was very passionate about making it possible for African American people to participate in commerce," says Malveau, who worked alongside Harris over the years, particularly when she was at Bennett College, Harris's alma mater. Consider Tim Catlett and Progressive Business Solutions, the business he founded 33 years ago and continues to operate alongside his wife Sonia and their children, Tim Jr. and Sadie. Sales in 2019 topped $6 million, and despite pivoting to meet the evolving supply needs dictated by the pandemic, Catlett says no employees have been furloughed or laid off. The company, which has 25 full-time and 5 part-time employees, qualified for a $150,000 PPP loan to help bridge the tumultuous times. Harris's influence has helped Catlett over the years when it came to questions of finance and how to find the best employees, but especially when it came to connecting his small business with large corporations. Ms. Harris was such a strong, consistent advocate for small minority-owned businesses. She was always thinking of the needs of small businesses and trying to convince large corporations to have that same mindset and work with them, Catlett says. She had a big impact on you as an individual and you as a business. She was the person who said, "You know you can." The confidence she inspired personally and through training provided by the Institute helped business owners like Catlett go for the big contracts. "If you don't try, you will never get it. That's what she told us," he says. "I never felt IBM was too big that I couldn't at least do something for them." Witness to that fact, two of the biggest accounts that Progressive Business Solutions serves are Duke University and Medical Center, and First Citizens Bank. Supplier diversity. At the Institute, Price is on a mission to take Harris's mantra to the next level, and he wants to see the organization act as a coach to help corporations launch a supplier diversity program. In the 14 years he led supplier diversity for Novant Healthcare, spending grew from $19 million to $114 million. It's an easy way for corporations to do community reinvestment. Part of my argument at Novant was that we wanted all patients to come to us, but we really wanted patients who could pay for the care, he says. The way to enable that was to be sure the local community had jobs, and supplier diversity was key. If you're going to spend money anyway, spend it within your footprint with businesses that will hire people who will potentially be your customers, Price explains. During his time at Novant, Price also helped create a loan guarantee program for the suppliers, moving a portion of the organization's money to minority-owned M&F Bank, where they ultimately had $10 million on deposit to leverage for loans. Instead of a corporation putting all their money in large majority banks, we encourage putting some in a minority-owned bank. It's a way they can repurpose money they already use, he says. Racial audits. Despite many opportunities to collaborate and address areas of economic inequality, there is a growing concern that COVID-19 will continue to widen the disparity gaps. If there's something that keeps me up at night, it's that. It's the feeling like we're not just treading water, our heads are bobbing in the water, Price says. Education is an immediate example. As school systems rely increasingly on online learning, Malveaux believes COVID-19 is going to widen the achievement gap. How many people who live in inner cities have broadband? If you have 3 kids and 1 computer, how does that work out? Yes, some school districts are giving young people laptops, but there's still the broadband issue, she says. The way to address this and other areas of inequality, she believes, is through proactive public policy. If we believe there have been injustices that have caused a gap in income, occupation, wealth, housing, education, then we should do a racial audit. If we really are moving towards equity and equality, every time we pass a piece of public policy, then we should ask, how does this open or widen the wealth gap? Because our overriding interests need to be to narrow the wealth gap, Malveaux says. Attorney Stormy Forte, appointed last month to replace Sage Martin on the Raleigh City Council and the first African-American woman to serve on the City Council, looks to the legacy of Harris as a role model for how to work with other leaders and effect change. It was very good to watch Ms. Harris in meetings because she would address whatever needed to be done in a very purposeful and intentional way. She showed us it's okay to go in and ask for things you need for your business and not to shy away from people who wield the power, Forte says. Among the issues facing Raleigh, Forte puts gentrification high on the list. How do we protect the interests of investments from years ago, she asks. Affordable housing is another. Particularly for professionals that are essential, such as teachers and first responders, Forte wants to work on creating access to affordable housing within the city limits. It all comes back to the people who can make a difference intentionally stepping up to change the economic inequalities that prevail. That starts with the way we think, she says. Many of us take those things, homes and jobs, for granted, Price explains. We have generational wealth in our family that has been passed down, and it's not just wealth in terms of money. It's also mentality. If someone in your family owned a home or a business, it was like a natural instinct that you could become a homeowner or start a business. What people want, he asserts, is an opportunity to take care of themselves and their families. Maybe that means a job, or maybe it means starting a business that creates jobs for other people. It's not a handout, Price says. People want an opportunity, which is the foundation of this country. Along with this article, there's a section called Higher Education. Colleges face diversity issues. Although a higher percentage of blacks are attending colleges, diversity lags in mainstream universities. The college enrollment rate for African American youth ages 18 to 24 increased from 31% in 2000 to 37% in 2018. For whites, the enrollment rate increased from 39% to 42%. At local universities, the racial gap is pronounced. The incoming enrollment in 2019 at NC State University had the least diversity. Of 4,822 first-year students, 69% were white and only 5% were black. Asian Americans represented 8%, and Hispanic Latinx were 6%. In the fall of 2019, undergraduate students at Duke University were 41% white, 21% Asian American, 9% African American, and 7% Hispanic Latinx. Students from other countries or unidentified ethnicities made up the remainder. Diversity among Duke graduate students was even less representative of the U.S. population, 41% white, 30% international, 9% Asian American, 6% African American, and 3% Hispanic Latinx. The undergraduate mix at UNC Chapel Hill more closely resembles the racial mix in the total population, but remains skewed. African Americans make up only 11% of the student enrollment, while whites account for 66% and Asian Americans 18%. 10% of UNC student enrollment are Hispanic Latinx, and 3% are American Indian Alaska Native. College enrollment is projected to mirror population demographics over the next decade. The U.S. Census Bureau estimates in 2030, blacks will represent both 14% of the total population and 15% of enrolled college students. By comparison, whites will account for 56% of the population and 52% of college enrollment. Hispanic Latinx will be 21% of both the population and college enrollment. Also in the Promise Of section, there's a column written by Henry C. McCoy, Jr., Ph.D., who currently teaches entrepreneurship at NC Central University in Durham. The headline, Averting Economic Crisis Needs Intentional Disruption. There is an old saying in economics that when the white community gets the flu, the black community gets pneumonia. This is a simple way of saying that when things are economically bad for white people, that it is substantially worse for black people. Even during the best of times, black unemployment is still double that of white unemployment. Black startups still get less than 1% of venture capital. Black businesses still are denied loans at much higher rates than white businesses, and the racial wealth gap continues to grow. These disparities are even more pronounced during economic downturns. This has led me to spend much of the last 4 months asking the question, if blacks get pneumonia when whites get the flu, then when whites get COVID-19, what do blacks get? I've spent a lot of time expressing to media outlets that this is a unique economic crisis. It is an economic crisis driven by a health crisis, and until we get the health crisis solved, or at least contained, then the economic crisis will not be solved. We can adapt to the environment and reopen the economy with parameters such as social distancing, disinfecting strategies, or wearing masks, but nothing takes the place of curing the virus and disease that is ravaging our society. As part of that broader economic conversation, I have been asked about the state of black businesses during the pandemic. As with every other statistic, blacks have suffered the worst effects of this current crisis. This is also the case in business ownership, where blacks have less personal wealth to fall back on, been unable to access federal programs like the Paycheck Protection Program, and have been shuttering at incredible rates. These negative outcomes are not new to the black community. However, the pandemic has further exposed, exacerbated, and accelerated them. Though America and our local cities and regions are quickly diversifying, the business success ecosystem is not diversifying as fast, if at all. Every major region in North Carolina has seen dramatic increases in black entrepreneurship in recent years. Yet this has not resulted in an increase in black wealth. This is because the majority of those firms remain sole proprietorships and never grow beyond that. White-founded firms continue to control more than 90% of most industry sectors and nearly $9 out of every $10 in business revenue. This inequity, surprisingly, is often even greater in regions that are economically prosperous and deemed more socially progressive, like San Francisco, Denver, and our own research triangle. If the triangle was reduced to 100 people, 100 firms, and $100 in annual business revenue, the major racial breakdowns would be roughly as follows. 60 whites would share ownership of 87 firms and $94 in revenue. 6 Asians would share 7 firms and $3.30. 11 Hispanics would share 3 firms and $2.10. And 19 blacks would share 4 firms and $1.10. Imagine 19 people living off of $1.10 per year. These figures represent pre-coronavirus. There are a lot of things that corporate America and its leaders could do to support black business. This includes investing risk capital into black firms, procuring and partnering with black firms, and ensuring that their own firms are moving beyond tokenism in their hiring practices. Beyond that, this is a time to move from sympathy for the black business owner to empathy. The current state of black America and black business relative to other groups is the product of its own pandemic, racism. Just as the case with COVID-19, many of us suffering had no hand in starting the virus, but we spread it through our actions and communication. We mask it and practice social distancing in hopes that it will disappear, but until we destroy or at least contain the virus, our economy will never reach its full capacity. For white firms who are being destroyed, to no fault of your own, by a closed economy, lack of sufficient resources, programs that don't address the core problem, this is the normal life of the black business owner trying to navigate a systemically racist world. If corporate America, philanthropic America, and the public sector don't give this racism pandemic the attention that it deserves, then the answer to my earlier question is obvious. When white America gets COVID-19, black America dies. And finally, in a section called Love and Dignity, we have the op-ed piece written by John Lewis. Lewis, answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe. John Lewis, the civil rights leader who died on July 17, wrote this essay shortly before his death to be published in the New York Times upon the day of his funeral. While my time here has now come to an end, I want you to know that in the last days and hours of my life, you inspired me. You filled me with hope about the next chapter of the great American story when you used your power to make a difference in our society. Millions of people motivated simply by human compassion laid down the burdens of division. Around the country and the world, you set aside race, class, age, language, and nationality to demand respect for human dignity. That is why I had to visit Black Lives Matter Plaza in Washington, though I was admitted to the hospital the following day. I just had to see and feel it for myself that, after many years of silent witness, the truth is still marching on. Emmett Till was my George Floyd. He was my Rashard Brooks, Sandra Bland, and Breonna Taylor. He was 14 when he was killed, and I was only 15 years old at the time. I will never, ever forget the moment when it became so clear that he could easily have been me. In those days, fear constrained us like an imaginary prison, and troubling thoughts of potential brutality committed for no understandable reason were the bars. Though I was surrounded by two loving parents, plenty of brothers, sisters, and cousins, their love could not protect me from the unholy oppression waiting just outside that family circle. Unchecked, unrestrained violence and government-sanctioned terror had the power to turn a simple stroll to the store for some Skittles or an innocent morning jog down a lonesome country road into a nightmare. If we are to survive as one unified nation, we must discover what so readily takes root in our hearts that could rob Mother Emanuel Church in South Carolina of her brightest and best, shoot unwitting concertgoers in Las Vegas, and choke to death the hopes and dreams of a gifted violinist like Elijah McClain. Like so many young people today, I was searching for a way out, or some might say a way in, and then I heard the voice of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on an old radio. He was talking about the philosophy and discipline of nonviolence. He said we are all complicit when we tolerate the injustice. He said it is not enough to say it will get better by and by. He said each of us has a moral obligation to stand up, and speak out. When you see something that is not right, you must say something. You must do something. Democracy is not a state. It is an act, and each generation must do its part to help build what we call the beloved community, a nation and world society at peace with itself. Ordinary people with extraordinary vision can redeem the soul of America by getting in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. Voting and participating in the democratic process are key. The vote is the most powerful nonviolent change agent you have in a democratic society. You must use it because it is not guaranteed. You can lose it. You must also study and learn the lessons of history because humanity has been involved in this soul-wrenching existential struggle for a very long time. People on every continent have stood in your shoes through decades and centuries before you. The truth does not change, and that is why the answers worked out long ago can help you find solutions to the challenges of our time. Continue to build union between movements stretching across the globe, because we must put away our willingness to profit from the exploitation of others. Though I may not be here with you, I urge you to answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe. In my life, I've done all I can to demonstrate that way of peace, the way of love and nonviolence is the more excellent way. Now is your turn to let freedom ring. When historians pick up their pens to write the story of the 21st century, let them say it was your generation who laid down the heavy burdens of hate at last, and that peace finally triumphed over violence, aggression, and war. So I say to you, walk with the wind, brothers and sisters, and let the spirit of peace and the power of everlasting love be your guide. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. First headline, prime Raleigh location likely to be divided up into lots. The owner of a coveted lot on White Oak Road in Raleigh decided to pivot on his plans after a series of discussions with developers and real estate brokers, and the leafy location is now likely to be divided up into five homes. Anuj Mittal, CEO of the MJM Group Hotel Company, bought nearly 3 acres at 2529 White Oak Road in a federal bankruptcy auction last year for $2.1 million. The elevated property, which had been owned by Celeste Broughton, is on a prime location on a tree-lined Raleigh street inside the Beltline. All that attracted my wife and I to say, let's look at this and buy it, Mittal says. Our plan was to build our family home. But his discussions with others led me to believe the highest and best use of this property is not to build an estate home. It's impractical to build a home and estate home covering the property and make any financial sense of it. For us, it did not make any financial sense. The property is now listed by Chapel Residential for $3.5 million and could be sold as one piece or broken up into five different lots. Mittal said Johnny Chapel convinced me to look at alternative plans. The property can be many different things to many different people, Chapel says. It can be a private 3-acre estate to one individual buyer, or what we're seeing the most interest in is a small assemblage of smaller lots that could support 3 or 4 or 5 single-family homes. Mittal says it's likely that the lot winds up with a series of homes that sell for $2.25 million to $2.5 million. We're not going to have a problem with getting the property sold, Chapel says. The Rubik's Cube now is, what does that look like? It's kind of letting the market tell us what they prefer. NCCU Law School launches initiative. Amid the ongoing national conversation on racial justice, the NC Central University School of Law is launching an initiative on social justice and anti-racism. The Social Justice and Racial Equality Initiative aims to provide educational outreach on issues such as racial equity, social justice, and other societal concerns. NCCU School of Law has been educating social justice advocates for over 80 years, and most of our graduates accept public service positions, so the initiative aligns with our mission, says Brown Lewis, dean of the law school. The effort will include partnerships with the NCCU School of Business and Department of Criminal Justice, as well as offer a social justice lecture series. The initiative also establishes a social justice research center to conduct research and publish papers on these issues. UNC students scramble as dorm remains closed. A college year like no other in the Triangle is underway, and one well-known residence hall at UNC Chapel Hill is eerily silent. In late July, residents at Granville East were informed the dorm would be closed for weeks because renovations involving heating and air conditioning were taking longer than expected, according to the Daily Tar Heel. Granville Towers dates to the 1960s and was one of the first private residences on a college campus. Granville is popular because of its location near Franklin Street and higher amenities than most normal dorms. But the closing of Granville East has exacerbated students and parents. Some students won't move in until the middle of September and were given the option of staying in a hotel or canceling their contract with Granville. While UNC students moved into Granville South and Granville West this week, Granville East was marked off by orange cones as parents and students scrambled to make hotel arrangements. As much as I hate all this, in Granville's defense, UNC did move up the start date, one parent wrote on Facebook. It's just typical 2020. A local pizza hangout in Raleigh is for sale. Lily's Pizza has operated in Five Points since 1994 and is known for its high-quality pies. The restaurant is on the market for $375,000, according to bizbysell.com, a website that highlights local businesses for sale. The notice says the owner is ready to retire and lists cash flow of $100,000 with gross revenue at $900,000 and rent of $3,100. Lily, by the way, was a pet of one of the three founders. Nash County is inching closer to the Triangle. Nash County has joined the Research Triangle Regional Partnership, which drives economic development for the area. Nash becomes the 12th county in the RTRP, and the connection shows how the Triangle's explosive growth is seeping out into the surrounding counties. Nash's vibrant economy, strong workforce, and strategic location make it an ideal place for businesses, and we look forward to leveraging the resources of the entire partnership to support the county's economic development efforts, says Ryan Combs, executive director of the RTRP. Nash County officials noted that the county straddles I-95 and also has Highway 64 cutting through it. The county has evolved over the years into an advanced manufacturing and pharmaceutical powerhouse, which makes it an ideal fit for the Triangle region, says Andy Hagee, director of economic development for Nash County. And in our last article, finance teams take center stage as firms count their pennies. Finance teams are front and center when it comes to dealing with the impact of COVID-19, according to a report just released by tax software firm Avalara, which has an office in Durham. The survey, conducted in conjunction with Zora, found that 80% of financial pros confirm they have been very or somewhat involved in their company's internal and external response to the pandemic. And nearly 60% of those surveyed reported that customers have been seeking delayed payments for services. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Banking, Tech, and Transportation page, written by Lauren Onasorge. Scooter firm backed by Bolt heading to Durham. Don't have the speed of a world-class sprinter? You can still get around quickly in the Bull City. A new fleet of sanitation-equipped scooters is about to hit the streets in Durham as a company backed by Olympic gold medalist Usain Bolt has picked Durham for its next rollout. Starting August 6, Bolt Mobility will launch with an initial fleet of 80 scooters, says Will Nicholas, Executive Vice President of Operations for the company. But we have plans to essentially double that in the coming weeks, he says. Founded in 2018, Bolt Mobility is competing for a share of the rapidly growing e-scooter market, which is projected to expand to $41.98 billion in value by 2030 globally, from $18.6 billion last year, according to a February report from Grandview Research. Its leadership team includes Bolt, a sprinter from Jamaica. The company has been working with the city of Durham on its rollout for some time and has obtained a permit to operate in the city. The permit, provided to the Triangle Business Journal by the city, shows permission has been granted through July, provided the company follows the rules, and that includes regulations concerning COVID-19. Nicholas says the company's response to the pandemic is what really sets it apart from rivals such as Bird and Lime. Safety is at the core of our ethos, he says. I think our design features really demonstrate that. Bolt scooters, for example, have larger wheels and brighter lights than much of the competition, Nicholas says, but the pandemic has forced the company to elevate its safety features. Now, with the idea that any surface can be of danger because of this virus transmission, we have added extra steps to make sure our scooters were as hygienic as possible, he says. Digital bank targets Durham for growth. With an all-digital bank, when an all-digital bank opens its first location outside of Manhattan this fall, it will be because of COVID-19. That's according to Judith Irwin, CEO of New York-based Grasshopper Bank. The four-year-old bank is negotiating lease options in Durham with plans to open its first branch as early as September. COVID precipitated us wanting to have a second location in a very different region, she says. We had always talked about having loan production offices in other urban areas, but we decided with COVID we wanted to mitigate the risk of being at 21st and Broadway, downtown Manhattan, with a completely different region. Irwin was very familiar with Durham. She was part of the team that founded Durham's Square One Bank 15 years ago. I have a lot of friends who live in the area, so when it came time for us to continue recruiting, we were very successful in Durham, she says. We are a digital bank, so we don't have to physically be anywhere, which has been great during COVID because we're all at home. When the bank decided to open an office outside of New York, Durham was really the only location it considered, she says, citing its location as an hour's flight away. The new office can accommodate the 5 employees Grasshopper has in the region and will be full service, capable of taking deposits and making loans. As of March 31st, the bank had total assets of about $100 million, according to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And just below that article, there's a Keeping Watch section with a quote from Craig Nix, First Citizens Bank Chief Financial Officer, speaking on a rare earnings call recently. Keep in mind, we are continually looking at the expense levers we have and are constantly evaluating them. For example, certain branch closures could be accelerated and the hiring freeze could be extended. But the real takeaway I hope to impress upon you is that we believe we are being good stewards here and expenses are continually monitored and reviewed. Mileage tax might be North Carolina's answers to gas tax problem. The gas tax, one of the oldest taxes levied to North Carolinians, is unsustainable. That has long been the take of experts who for years have been watching the impact of rising travel trends such as electric vehicles on the tax. The tax at about 36.1 cents per gallon is a major funding source for the North Carolina Department of Transportation. But could a mileage-based tax be the answer? Maybe. That's according to a presentation at a recent North Carolina First Commission meeting, which called taxing by mileage instead of fuel consumed a revenue-neutral option. Patricia Hendren, executive director of the Eastern Transportation Coalition, shared a survey showing the pervasive belief that charging by mileage would burden rural communities where commutes are often longer. If we move from a fuel-based approach to a distance-based approach, overall the change is minor, but there is a shift. It is a shift that is not in line with perception, she said, pointing to data showing rural households would pay on average $17 less via a mileage tax each year, and urban households $10 more. Statewide, there's an average change of $0 by swapping to a mileage-based plan. Rural households now pay an average of $343 in annual fuel taxes, far above the $243 average in urban areas, Hendren said. Statewide, the average is $297 a year. Swapping fuel tax for mileage tax would be a revenue-neutral approach, she said, but changing systems wouldn't be easy. The survey showed most North Carolinians aren't familiar with mileage-based taxes. And finally, in a section called He Said It, weeks after officially pulling plans for the Atlantic Coast Pipeline project, Dominion Energy CEO Tom Farrell told analysts the demand for the fracked natural gas it would have pumped in had not changed. The need has not changed at all. The result of it is that need will go unmet as a result of the cancellation of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. And that was Dominion Energy CEO Tom Farrell testifying to the South Carolina Public Service Commission recently. And now we read the On Real Estate page written by Caleb Harshberger. Downtown Raleigh apartments change hands. A high-end apartment complex in downtown Raleigh changed hands recently in one of the few large commercial sales in July. Chicago's Banner Real Estate Group closed on the sale of the Lincoln Apartments for $48.75 million on July 30, 5 years after completing the development. The property is situated on 2 acres at 408 Hargett Street, one block east of Moore Square. The buyer is an LLC managed by Alan Laufer with a listed phone number and address that's the same as the Lincoln Apartments. Built in 2015, the Lincoln Apartments feature 224 units across 5 stories, with rental rates ranging from as low as $1,070 for a studio apartment to as high as $2,595 for a two-bedroom unit, according to Apartments.com. Amenities include a pool, fitness center, movie theater, and more. The apartments were developed in a joint venture between Banner Apartments and Raleigh investors John Florian of the Florian Companies and John Healy of Hyde Street Holdings, with Banner providing the bulk of the funding. JLL represented Banner in the sale through the firm's Capital Markets Investment Advisory Team, including managing directors Jeff Glenn and Andrea Howard, senior director Alan Lynch, and directors Kaylor Mark and John Curran. Debt and financing was led by managing directors Roger Edwards and Matthew Schoenfeld. Epic Games co-founder acquires retail office center in Holly Springs. A triangle couple with ties to a Cary-based video game developer recently closed on the purchase of a retail, dining, and office complex in Holly Springs. Epic Games vice president and co-founder Mark Rain and his wife, Tara Dow Rain, spent $13.7 million on the purchase of Town Hall Commons in Holly Springs through their LLC, Reindeer Holdings. The seller, Trustwell Property Group, developed the property over the last few years. The property features 45,000 square feet of mixed-use space, complete with retail, office, and dining in downtown Holly Springs. The property is situated on about 1 acre at 242 South Main Street next to the Holly Springs Town Hall amid a collection of office and retail buildings. Tenants at Town Hall Commons include restaurants such as Osha Thai Kitchen and Sushi, Sir Walter Coffee, Kitchen and Vianney Risto Bar, as well as several boutique stores and retailers including a fitness center, salons, and healthcare providers, among others. Boston developer ramps up in Durham with buy of Durham.id. A two-tower tech district in downtown Durham changed hands with the closing of the largest sale in the region since the start of the pandemic. Joint owners Bain Capital and Longfellow Real Estate Partners recently announced Longfellow has agreed to pay $138 million for full ownership of Durham.id, a recently developed two-tower tech and innovation site at 200 and 300 Morris Street. "Holding these assets for us is really strategic and furthers our commitment to Durham," says Longfellow partner Jessica Brock. "I think both Bain and we feel it's a great result." She says the companies are keeping the breakdown of ownership before the sale confidential. The Durham.id site is made up of 2 large office buildings and an 8-story parking deck, totaling 330,369 square feet of Class A mixed-use office space with ground floor retail and more. The joint venture began in 2014 with Longfellow as the developer and Bain as the capital partner. Today, existing tenants at 300 Morris Street include a collection of tech and startup firms, as well as Longfellow itself, which announced in October it would be relocating its North Carolina headquarters to the recently delivered building. Across the street, Duke Clinical Research Institute has leased all the space in the 200 Morris Street building. Club Corps sells Holly Springs Golf Club. A leading company in managing private golf and country clubs has sold its long-held Holly Springs Golf Club, but the company isn't planning to leave the property anytime soon. Dallas-based Club Corps, one of the country's largest owners of private clubs, closed on the sale and long-term leaseback of the Devil's Ridge Golf Club in a $4 million transaction August 4. The sale brings to an end Club Corps' 2 decades of ownership of the club. The buyer is an LLC that deed records show shares an address with New York hedge fund Sculptor Capital. And while the property is under new ownership, Club Corps will continue operating the club under a long-term lease agreement. That lease lasts 20 years, according to county records, with options for Club Corps to extend the agreement. The club, located in the Sunset Ridge community, will stay in the Club Corps network, and a company representative says the sale will not affect the day-to-day operations at the club and will not impact employees or members. Hundreds more homes, townhomes planned for the town of Rollsville. A Charlotte home builder has plans to bring hundreds of new homes to Rollsville, calling for a mix of single-family homes and townhouses south of downtown in the fast-growing Wake County community. Hopper Communities Incorporated filed plans earlier this year for the Wheeler Tract, calling for 335 homes, including hundreds of single-family homes and up to 130 townhomes to be built out over the next 6 years. Single-family and townhome units will be built in two phases, according to plans filed with the town. Townhomes will be situated on the eastern side of the property, accessed off Mitchell Mill Road, and the amenities will be in the middle of the property. Amenities will include a community pool, cabana, tot lot, dog park, public greenway, and pocket parks interspersed throughout the site. Filings with the town estimate the project to be built out by 2026, with construction starting no earlier than next year. And now we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Ed page, written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. Wilmington's PPD inks Pfizer deal. Wilmington-based PPD announced August 3 it has signed a three-year agreement with New York-based Pfizer, where PPD will provide drug development services to advance Pfizer's portfolio. Pfizer can extend the agreement for an additional 2 years. Exact financial terms were not disclosed. PPD CEO David Simmons said, PPD is strategically positioned to continue supporting Pfizer in its pursuit of breakthroughs that change patients' lives. PPD, like other contract research organizations, face the reality of COVID-19 affecting its operations. It also follows PPD's return to public markets in February. The firm ended 2019 with more than $345.2 million in cash and cash equivalents. UNC to lead $40 million program to create liquid fuel from sunlight. The U.S. Department of Energy recently announced it will provide $100 million in funding to solar energy projects, including a $40 million award to the North Carolina-based Center for Hybrid Approaches in Solar Energy to Liquid Fuels, also known as CHASE. Sunlight is the world's most basic energy source, and an ability to generate fuels directly from sunlight has the potential to revolutionize the U.S. energy economy. Undersecretary for Science Paul Dabber said, this effort will keep America at the forefront of artificial photosynthesis research, a field of great challenge but also huge promise. UNC Chapel Hill leads the CHASE partnership, which will use the funding to develop hybrid photoelectrodes for fuel production, combining semiconductors for light absorption with molecular catalysts for conversion and fuel production. With this support, CHASE will build on a strong foundation of solar energy research here at UNC and establish critical new partnerships that will enable the transformative scientific advances needed to realize liquid solar fuels, said Jillian Dempsey, CHASE's deputy director. And now we turn to the On Business page, written by Matthias Miller. Even PPP couldn't save this Chapel Hill restaurant on Franklin Street. A downtown Chapel Hill restaurant has shut down for good amid the pandemic, but this one was facing an uphill fight even before COVID-19. Lula's, located at the normally busy intersection of East Franklin and North Columbia Streets across from Top of the Hill Restaurant and Brewery, has ceased operations after 2 years of business. The restaurant is owned by Chapel Hill Restaurant Group, CHRG, which also owned the iconic Spanky's in the same location before it made the shift to Lula's in 2018 after Spanky's revenue began to decline at the end of its four decades in business. Spanky's sales had gone down over the past few years, and I think everyone has talked about the issues with Franklin Street in downtown Chapel Hill, says Greg Overbeck, co-owner and marketing director of CHRG. The two main things being the parking problem or the perception of parking problems and just a glut of restaurants for a town with the population that it has. Lula's, like Spanky's, couldn't survive in the prime location known for its lofty rents. It's a similar scenario across the street where the space below Top of the Hill has struggled to maintain restaurant tenants. Overbeck said he was excited about the concept of Lula's and that restaurant managed to amass a small following since its opening, but never quite made enough consistent sales to reach its revenue goals. We were probably doing about 70% of the business we hoped we would do, Overbeck says. We were at about 30% or 25% short of getting to where we needed to be to cover costs. When COVID came along, it was the final straw, Overbeck says. According to data from the U.S. Small Business Administration, Chapel Hill Restaurant Group, which also owns Squids in Chapel Hill and Mez and Page Road Grill in Durham, was approved for a Paycheck Protection Program loan between $1 million and $2 million. Overbeck says the loan was essential to keep its restaurants open and maintain payroll. Lula's faced other obstacles. Its large upstairs event space didn't generate enough revenue to make up for the high rent of the Franklin Street location, Overbeck says. It was very difficult to get people to come uptown to have meetings and big graduation parties or rehearsal dinners in downtown Chapel Hill, Overbeck says. We were paying for space upstairs that we weren't using nearly enough. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Editor-in-Chief Sugata Mukherjee. The headline, Workers Should Directly Receive Relief Checks Through IRS. As Congress goes back and forth between the House and the Senate chambers to finalize the next multi-trillion dollar stimulus package for the country, there's an immense opportunity for the lawmakers to practice what they preach in their election campaigns. And that's taking care of the workers, millions of whom have lost their jobs due to business disruption in the past 6 months. Washington approved the Paycheck Protection Loan Program in two different tranches earlier this year, totaling almost $660 billion. About $530 billion went to some 5 million businesses, with another $130 billion left in the program. For people reading about PPP for the first time, essentially, companies filed an application with a lender such as banks, credit unions, and private capital outfits, which got the approval for the loan from the program administrator, the U.S. Small Business Administration. Then lenders promptly wired the loan money to the businesses. The loan is 100% guaranteed by the federal government, and companies have the option of not paying the loan back if they use the money specifically to aid their workers and pay their rent and utility bills. For lenders, another PPP-type program could be arduous, and frankly, we are hearing too many problems with what actually may have happened to some of that money. People buying yachts and Lamborghinis and spending money on interior decoration and real estate investing. There's a better way. Send the money directly to the workers. Here's how it can work. Use the IRS data to identify the workers who had full-time jobs in 2019. Then get employers to file requests along with statements as to the amount of the company's revenue loss during COVID-19. If the revenue loss was more than 50%, every worker in that organization will be eligible for a relief check. To make sure that business continues to run, a protection check equivalent to 50% of the business's 2019 operational profit will be sent as well. That way, a business can continue to pay for rent and utilities. All this money can essentially be a grant rather than a loan structured like the PPP, which we now see is unlikely to be repaid by a vast number of recipients. This is not a novel idea, really. Germany and South Korea sent money directly to the workers during COVID-19, and now the countries are focused on one thing, keeping the virus from spreading so things can get back to normal. The German program, Kurzarbeit, means short-time work. It allows financially distressed companies to drastically reduce worker hours, and the government pays the lost wages to the workers directly. This program actually has existed for more than 100 years in Germany, and first came to attention during the 2008 Great Recession. Under the German program, most workers don't get laid off and unemployment lines do not burst at the seams. In March, Germany had a jobless rate of 5%. In June, it was 6.2%. In contrast, U.S. unemployment rate in March was a shade above 4%. By June, it ballooned up to 11%. Would we have the discussion of whether to pay the unemployed workers $600 a week in federal benefits or $200 a week if we had implemented a direct worker relief program in the U.S.? Washington State Democrat Pramila Jayapal and Michigan Democrat Haley Stevens introduced a worker help bill in late May that really saw no light of day in Washington, D.C. That bill deserves another look. That could be a game changer for the economy. Durham Cocktail Lounge plans burger pop-up to keep afloat. And that's the first article we'll read on the On Restaurants and Retail page written by Dathan Kazik. While many privately owned bars remain closed due to Governor Roy Cooper's mandate, one Durham Cocktail Lounge is looking to bring some income to keep their vision afloat. Kingfisher, which closed March 15, is owned by Sean Umstead and Michelle Vanderwalker, will introduce Queen Burger, a pop-up burger bar in the parking lot behind Kingfisher. Since Kingfisher is not an ideal setting right now, given how intimate and hands-on the experience was designed to be, we've envisioned a new way to connect with our community, Umstead says. As Queen Burger, Umstead and Vanderwalker will serve two versions of what they refer to as smash burgers. Double-stacked beef burgers or house-made veggie burgers are topped with griddled onions, hoop cheese, pickles, and mayonnaise. Queen Burger is set to open to the crowd behind Kingfisher in mid-August. We have a lot of moving parts we're trying to transition, Umstead says. Michelle has painted a huge mural over the last couple of days, and we had to put down some reclaimed turf. Umstead had to furlough his entire staff, so this will be a way to bring back some employees. This is like restarting, so it takes a minute, but we'll get over this pretty soon. The duo also donated 15% of profits to Durham anti-racist organization named We Are. Bars ask politicians to support new restaurant act. The North Carolina Bar and Tavern Association, NCBATA, is asking Governor Roy Cooper and Senator Richard Burr to support new legislation making its way through Congress. The Restaurant Act, proposed by Senator Roger Wicker, a Republican from Mississippi, and Representative Earl Blumenauer, a Democrat from Oregon, would establish a $120 billion independent restaurant revitalization fund. Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina is a co-sponsor. North Carolina's 1,063 private bars closed 5 months ago. We elected these men to serve as our representatives, and they have a responsibility to act, says Zach Medford, president of NCBATA. We know the COVID-19 pandemic has forced the governor to make difficult decisions, but it shouldn't be a difficult choice for him to stand up and support North Carolina's small business owners, he says. Burr has yet to sign on in support of the Restaurant Act, and no word has come out of the governor's office on the bill. Currently, bars in restaurants, hotels, breweries, distilleries, wine tasting bars, and private bars have been allowed to open in limited capacity. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.